instance in the spring for tea picking, he goes on, unfazed. May I visit?
You're always welcome in Springwell Village, I answer. I'll never forget how you and Xianrong helped me when the bubble burst.
This year, will you take me to your hidden...
I am not too old to be still learning new English words. Incorrigible. Do you know that one? He drops all pretense of casual conversation.
Have you heard that the Poor Tea College now has a study base with a GPS system that can locate every tea tree over 1,000 years old on Yunnan's 26 tea mountains?
A knot instantly forms in my stomach. I swallow to push it down.
They want to protect China's most precious gifts, he continues. Once recorded, they can watch to make sure no one cuts down a tree to pick its leaves easily or carve graffiti in its bark. From high in the sky, they can see through mists, fog, and clouds to the outlines of mountains, boulders, and hollows.
Attempting to keep my expression as bland as possible, I let my eyes float over the crowd. Where is Jin? I need him.
The Poor Tea College is not the only institution or person to have GPS,
Mr. Huang intrudes on my silence.
Did you know I have access to it? Do you know what that means? For 21 years, I've been searching. No!
Unable to stop myself, I turn away. Moving through the mingling couples, I escape onto one of the little paths that wends around the lake.
Lian, wait!
He calls, switching to my Akan name. I try to compose myself.
There's so much you don't know,
he says when he reaches me.
I don't want to hear it. You've never trusted me, but you need to start now.
Why? So you can wheedle and pry your way into my life?
That's entirely unfair,
he responds, heated and defensive.
Somehow you blame me for things that happened to you when you were young, but I don't know what they were or what I did that was so terrible. Couldn't you think of it another way? Maybe my visits to Nanuo Mountain helped pave the way for your success.
You taught us about poor, but you've had nothing to do with what I've made of my life.
Really? Then how do you think you got into the Tea College? You know that Tea Master Sun and I are acquainted, but did you know the two of us have been friends for a long time? Why else would he accept you into two programs when not a single other person from a hill tribe was admitted to either?
Then I thank you for changing my life, I say. I start to leave, but he gently takes hold of my arm.
Have you ever wondered who your secret partner was in the Midnight Blossom tea shop?
Green Jade? A hand goes up to my mouth in surprise. Was that you?
One of my companies, yes. I was your partner.
He pauses to let the unbelievable news sink in.
And I came here tonight to warn you about the study base's plans.
I don't understand. Why would you do any of those things?
I need to repay your family.
His voice fades, and he gazes across the lake. The red reflections from the lanterns ripple across the surface. I wait. Finally, he goes on.
Your mother saved my son's life.
What are you talking about? My question comes out sharper than I intended, but I can't help feeling he's trying to put something over on me.
You've never asked about my wife, he says.
This is so. How odd. He pulls out his wallet and shows me a photo of a pretty young woman holding a baby in her arms.
I loved her very much, he says. She got breast cancer right after Xianrong was born. She didn't live to see his first birthday.
I'm sorry.
To lose a wife is terrible, and I'll always miss her. But nothing prepared me for the anguish I felt when Xianrong was diagnosed with bone cancer.
He was 3.
I'm speechless, trying to reconcile this information with my memories of our first encounter. The sound of the old PLA Jeep grinding its way through the forest, the initial unsettling sight of Mr. Huang in his strange clothes, and the little bald boy in what I now know was a Bart Simpson t-shirt, skipping up the path from the spirit gate to the main part of the village as if he knew exactly where he was going. Everything about those moments was alien and frightening. How was I to know Xian Rong was sick?
He'd had chemo and radiation therapies, Mr. Huang says, addressing my doubt. We'd tried alternative treatments. I won't go into every detail, but some friends in Hong Kong told me about the medicinal qualities of puer. I had to find the purest and most potent. Once I got to the Tea Mountains, I asked everywhere for the name of the best village doctor.
But you came to us because you were a connoisseur.
I wasn't a connoisseur, but I had a dying son and had to become one very quickly.
You said you were a collector, I insist. You came to make puer. We made it. You took it away.
I made puer and I took it away, true. I sold most of it, which is not what a collector would do.
Were we so gullible that we believed everything he said back then? Of course we were. Even so, I must look like I need more convincing.
How can I best prove it to you? Ah, so easy. I could have been the one to make truly simple elegant. Mr. Liu and I each had what we needed to make an iconic tea. But I wasn't on Nanuo for that. I came to Spring Well for your mother. She was the person everyone mentioned. If there was a cure for my son, then she would have it.
I replay those weeks in my mind. Xian Rong's exuberance never lasted very long, and he must have been bald from his treatments. And despite Ama's continued distrust of Mr. Huang, she'd always shown a particular fondness for the boy, letting him stay with her in the woman's side of the house in the afternoons when he was tired. And there was Mr. Huang's behavior, which at the time had seemed so strange. How easy he was to bargain with. How he'd said, "I need this." How much he was willing to pay for the mother tree's leaves during his second visit. Through it all, I'd been so absorbed with thoughts of San Pa, and uninformed about the outside world, that I hadn't searched beyond the surface of his words.
Your mother's tea healed my boy.
You don't truly believe that.
But I do believe it, and I want to prove it. I've been funding puer studies around the world, and we are discovering all kinds of benefits. But there's something about the tea from your grove that's different.
So you're asking for my tea for your personal gain?
No!
He puffs his chest, insulted.
Don't you see, Lian? We have to protect the trees. If I can find your grove, how long before the study base or some unscrupulous dealer does? The camphor trees won't hide your special trees forever.
Which tells me he really does know the location of the grove. Maybe he's been there already.
The 2 special tea cakes we made.
His voice drifts off again.
They had yellow threads which grew and spread.
I remember you telling me this before. Ama always relied on those for her toughest cases. And they're in Yanye's tea cake.
Those threads are what's so powerful. For years, I've scoured the mountains looking for other sources, but I haven't found one. They're only in your grove. And they're what saved Xian Rong when he had a recurrence in 2007.
I remember Mr. Huang coming to my shop in the tea market and telling me that he'd been to my village
and wondering why no one, not even Amma, had mentioned it.
And Amma treated him again? I ask.
He nods.
I told Xianrong the tea would help settle his stomach post-chemo. And since he loved your mom and Nanuo Mountain, he never asked questions and was content to obey. He's been cancer-free ever since.
Then let it go and be grateful.
Li Yan, he pleads. My son has recovered twice from cancer. My wife died from it. Did they have a genetic predisposition, or was it just bad luck? How can I know what will happen to my grandchildren and great-grandchildren?
Xianrong isn't even married yet, I respond, trying for a lighter tone. And you never like the girls he goes out with, anyway.
But this isn't the time for levity.
One day he'll find the right girl,
Mr. Huang leans in.
Then what? You recite the lineage. What about my lineage? What about Xianrong's? You've known him for 21 years. What if he or his son or daughter gets sick? Your mother might be gone. You and I might not be here either. There would be no way to protect my family's security and longevity. You've never trusted me, but you should start now. I am a man who loves his son very deeply. What would you do for your son?
I don't tell Jin about my conversation with Mr. Huang. I don't call Amma to discuss what he said either. I hold all the information inside me, trying to process it. Out of everything he said, one question lingers. What would you do for your son? I find myself watching Paul when he draws his bow across his violin strings, when he kicks the ball during soccer practice, when he wakes screaming in the night. We Akka think so much about our ancestors and the spirit world in which they reside, but our sons and daughters in the world of the living prolong our lines in the direction of the future. They will be the next ancestors. They should be protected, but at what cost? By the time Paul and I leave for China the following month, I know what must happen. I hope my conviction will be enough to sway Amma. On our way to Springwell, we make a quick stop at the Social Welfare Institute to deliver clothes, toys, books, and other necessities. Paul always likes these visits, and even though he's only 8, he likes to make things for the kids, like puppets made from lunch bags. But this time, he asked if we could bring 3 laptops.
They could play games. They could even learn to read a little. When they're older, if they aren't adopted, they could do their homework. Mom, please!
Before we left home, I told Jin that our son is destined for a great university because he's already building his community service record. My husband had laughed and kissed the top of my head. And then it's on to Nanuo Mountain. Tea picking season is always so busy that Amma and I usually don't visit my grove until I'm just about to return home. Not this time. Directly upon our arrival in Springwell, I ask her to come with me to my hidden grove. My Amma has reached 78 years on this earth. She's lived on Nanuo Mountain her entire life, breathing clean air, eating fresh food, and walking these mountains to care for tea trees and people alike. She's strong, and I lag behind as she strides up mountain trails that grow progressively narrow until the last one seems to disappear. She waits for me at the boulder, and together, we shimmy around it. What is another year to the mother and sister trees? In the 28 years I've known of their existence, they seem unchanged. Once I had thought of the grove as a place of pain, suffering, and death. Now, I am honored to have it as my legacy. But it may be so much more than that. I go straight to the mother tree and caress its bark. Yellow powder comes off on my palms, which I hold out for Amma to see.
"Do you know what this is?" I ask.
"It's a gift brought here by our nomadic mothers as they journeyed.
Mr. Huang thinks it's something more." Hearing his name, she scowls, turns her back to me, and walks to the edge of the cliff. I keep my yellowed hands before me as I come to her side. Together we stare out over the mountains.
"He says the yellow threads cured Xianrong," I say.
She looks at me out of the corner of her eye, deliberately avoiding my hands.
"The boy was dying when he first came to us. Anyone could see that. I did what I could. I gave him tea from the mother tree and many other remedies."
"And I made 2 cakes of tea solely from the mother tree, which Mr. Huang took for his son."
"I only knew about the one."
I wait for further recriminations. Instead, she says,
"Then you helped him too. Not everyone recovers on our mountain, as you know. He was lucky."
"What if he gets sick again?" I ask.
"Each year when he visits, I look at him. He is healthy. If someday he comes to me sick, I'll do what I can for him as I do for every person on Nanuo Mountain."
"What about when you become an ancestor? What if one of Xianrong's children gets sick?"
"You can..."
I don't let her finish.
"I can deliver a baby and help a girl with a pimple. Beyond that? You are the last woman in our line with your skills. And we don't know why Xianrong got better when many others don't."
I give Amma time to absorb what I'm saying. Then, "And there's one more thing. I'll never stop respecting my Amma. She's farmed, harvested vegetables and threshed rice, raised and slaughtered animals, cooked for an entire household, spun thread, woven cloth, made clothes and embroidered them. She's walked every trail on our mountain. She's attended births and cared for the weak, ill, and dying. I love her. And having to explain the idea of satellites and GPS to her hurts me deeply. They are as far-fetched to her as electricity, telephones, and televisions once were to me, and she looks horrified as I come to my frightening conclusion. People are looking for this place. Mr. Huang already knows where it is.
But no man can see it.
Amma says, her insistence carrying the weight of generations.
I'll never let that stranger.
Don't you see? It might not be him. A choke of understanding grabs my throat as I finally accept what he told me that night at the party. It won't be him. He warned us. Consider what that means. The inevitability of what's coming. As uncontrollable as the wind.
No man can come here.
It's agonizing for me to hear her fear and sadness.
They'll die as your grandfather died.
This is brutally tragic and terrifying for me, too. But I come back at her with the type of reasoning I know she'll understand. What happened to grandfather was fate. It could have happened anywhere.
But we must keep this place a secret.
I raise my palms so she can't avoid seeing them. Isn't it time we learn what this is? Where it came from originally, and if there's more out there? How and if it works? If it can be recreated. If it can help.
But the women in our line.
Yes, the women in our line, including you and me, are linked by these yellow threads. You and the generations before you protected the mother and sister trees from wars, caravans, and nomads that passed across Nanuo Mountain over many centuries. But now, people? Maybe callous men, maybe evil women, maybe deceitful dealers, maybe ruthless scientists are going to come here with their GPS whether we want them to or not. Maybe our line has been protecting the mother tree for this moment.
I'll always help the boy, Ama says, despairing.
If you can treat him, then why not those on the next mountain? Would you turn away someone who came to you from Yiwu or Laobanjiang sick himself with an ailing wife or a feverish child in his arms? Of course you wouldn't. If you say yes to someone from the next mountain, then what about people from other parts of China? Ama begins to weep. I've cornered her with undeniable facts. Suddenly, she looks like a broken, frail, old woman. I've done that to her.
Who can we trust to take it out?
She mumbles, her voice trembling.
What's going to happen to the trees once others know about them?
I take her in my arms and hold her tight. I don't know the answers.
A pilgrimage to the place of origin. We linger at the entrance to the TSA security line. Mom looks elegant in a pair of cream-colored trousers and a peach cashmere sweater. Dad's wearing shorts and a Lakers t-shirt. I'm in skinny jeans and a hoodie. My hair is pulled back in a ponytail. In my carry-on, I've got my tea cake, laptop, books, and other necessities for the flight. I want to meet him, Dad says for about the 50th time. How many variations of a response can I come up with? He'll get here. Maybe he's inside already. Even if he doesn't show up, which he will, I'll be fine. This time I try out, I'm sure he's coming. Dad gives me a look, and Mom says, Now, Dan, stop worrying. Think of the places I've gone for research. I don't like that either, and you aren't my little girl. She'll be 21 in the fall, I know, but look, you two, I'd better get through security, I say. I don't want to miss my flight. Dad sighs. Are you really going to fly off to China with some random Chinese man none of us have met? Oh, Dad, you're such a dad, and I love you for it. He gives me a weak smile, but truly, why didn't I introduce everyone when I had the chance? Because I wanted to do this on my own, prove I was capable, impress Mom and Dad with my independence, etc. Mom hugs me and whispers in my ear, I love you. Be careful. We'd prefer if you call, but if you can't, promise to send an email or text every day so we know you're safe. When I start to pull away, she draws me even closer. I've known worry before. Those terrible nights when you nearly died and your bad spell in high school. But this is a whole new level. So don't get me wrong. Your dad would never forgive me and I'd never forgive myself. There's nothing to worry about, I whisper back. I'll be fine. Which is about as far from the truth as I can get because despite my brave words, I'm scared half out of my pants. Where is he? How am I supposed to do this trip by myself? I go through more or less the same routine with my dad. I join the line and pull out my passport, but Mom and Dad don't leave. Even after I pass through security and start up the elevator to the gates, I see them standing where I left them. One last round of waves and smiles, and then I'm on my own. When I get to the gate, the first and business class passengers have already boarded through a special door. The cattle, of which I'm a part, are funneled down a separate jetway, so I don't get to see if Sean's already seated. My parents volunteering, if that's the right word, to buy me a coach ticket for the flight from L.A. to Guangzhou was just one of the many ways they tried to dissuade me from this trip. They have enough miles to have gotten me a seat in business, and it wouldn't have cost them a dime. By the time they accepted the fact that I was going no matter what, and they offered to pay to boot me up to business, it's the least we can do. I had to act above it all, as in, oh, Mom, Dad, thank you so much for offering, but I want to seem like everyone else. And now I'm squished in with a bunch of strangers going on an adventure to the middle of nowhere, as Sean and the people on the Tufts team have repeatedly described it. At least I'm on the aisle. The plane taxis to the runway. The pilot revs the engines and we barrel along until we lift off, passing over the sandy beach and above the ocean. The plane banks to the right, north. My hands grip the armrests as we hit a few bumps. I wouldn't be here now if I hadn't met Sean. A year ago, on a whim, really, I'd gone to the Tea Expo at the Long Beach Convention Center. On the first day, I attended a seminar on using the unique flowers of different teas to make artisanal cocktails. It's the coming trend! It was the expo's most popular event, and I came out of the meeting room more than a little tipsy from sampling Earl Grey-infused whiskey, vodka with hibiscus tea ice cubes, and drinks with names like Tea Teeny, with vodka, lavender, rosemary, and chamomile, Sencha Flip, with gin, Japanese green tea, and frothed egg whites, and Liber Tea, made with wild turkey, honey, tea, and basil. If I weren't going to Stanford, I commented to one of the other attendees, I could open a bar and serve all kinds of drinks using tea, dry ice, spherification, foams, and infusions. Chemistry another way. The woman didn't even crack a smile. Those tea people take themselves very seriously. Next, I'd gone to a panel on the science of tea. I don't know what I was expecting, but it wasn't a rundown of studies going on around the world looking at the purported health benefits of something I'm interested in for personal reasons but don't drink myself, except for boba milk tea that I buy in the San Gabriel Valley, which is all about the tapioca balls anyway, and now maybe cocktails. Or that even, in a seminar like that one, they were going to serve tea. These scientists from Tufts University, the Tea Research Institute, and a place called the Antioxidants Research Laboratory, whatever that is, started in with all this data about a particular kind of tea called pu'er that reportedly can help with diabetes, lower blood pressure, prolong longevity, and produce palliative outcomes for everything from altitude sickness to gout to symptoms of HIV/AIDS. Talk about a buzzkill. I thought, some people will believe anything. I hate people who prey on the weak or sick, giving them false hope when they should be relying on medicine and science. So I was doing a whole pat myself on the back thing, I'm going to Stanford for real science, when they start showing slides like I'm in a chemistry or biology class. Randomized Double-Blind Placebo-Controlled Clinical Trials, RCT. Effects of tea on body weight, energy metabolism, and recovery from stress. Beverage formulated with green tea catechins, caffeine, and calcium. Increased 24-hour resting energy expenditure, REE, by 106 kilocalories, 4.6%, in 31 young, lean individuals. In 12-week RCT with green tea extract GTE 750 milligrams containing 141 milligrams catechins, to 60 sedentary and overweight BMI 27.7 individuals, increase in REE and decrease in body weight despite no change in food intake. In 6-week RCT with black tea, 76 males divided into two groups. Half receive caffeinated beverage made from tea, half receive caffeinated placebo. Both groups presented with challenging tasks with cortisol, blood pressure, blood platelet, and self-rated stress levels measured pre and post. 50 minutes after completion of tasks, cortisol levels drop 47% in T group compared to 27% given placebo. Suddenly, I felt on much firmer ground. They showed slides with chemical percentages, dosages, and study methodology for different age groups, sexes, and countries in studies that covered glucose tolerance, cardiovascular disease, bone density, cognitive function, neurodegenerative disease, and, of course, various types of cancer. Outcomes ranged from compelling to equivocal at best. Not exactly ringing endorsements, but I was intrigued, and I sure couldn't blame it on the second sample of Sencha Flip I drank earlier. At the end of the presentation, I asked for cards from all the participants, one of whom was Dr. Berry, who later agreed to let me work on her study. Feeling a bit giddy, I walked down the aisles of the show, and it was much like any expo, with a whole range of vendors, from the English tea cozy ladies to Kenyan tea plantation promoters, from Japanese women in kimonos doing a formal tea ceremony to Portland hipsters with flower-based products. I stopped for a moment to watch a man, Chinese, handsome, and 5 or so years older than I am, pouring tea for a group of people, letting the liquid slosh over the rims of the cups. It was truly messy and completely unlike the elegance in the Japanese booth. The man caught me observing him and called, "Join us." When I hesitated, he beckoned me with what had to be a Chinese proverb. "Every passing moment is the passing of life. Every moment of life is life itself." Who says that to a random stranger? It certainly wasn't a line I'd heard before, so I entered the booth and sat down. He introduced himself as Sean Wong. "Here," he said, pouring tea from a glass pitcher into a white porcelain cup. "I want you to sample my pu'er." The first sip of liquid blossomed in my mouth. Bitterness bubbled away by sweetness. He watched my reaction, smiled more to himself than to me, and then proceeded to brew several more vintages of pu'er, each one better than the last. One tea had such strong huigan, what he described as the overwhelming effect that this tea has on breath and opening the chest, that for a moment the world went dizzy. "That's because you're drinking history," he explained. His laugh made my heart race. And honestly, I could barely take my eyes off him. His cheekbones were sharp, his eyes seemed wary, his hair shone like lacquer. He was friendly and obviously some type of tea connoisseur. The careless way he poured the valuable teas, letting them overflow their little cups to show abundance, was oddly entrancing. Why he'd set up a stall at the expo wasn't and still isn't clear, but I'd gone to high school with plenty of girls like him, and now I was surrounded by his ilk, guys and girls, at Stanford, who are part of the People's Republic of China's wealthy and international jet-setting elite. I don't know what made me do it, but I mentioned my tea cake, bragging, I guess, or wanting to prolong my time with him. He was immediately intrigued. "They say that the most valuable tea will be found right here in Southern California," he said. "It would have come with a sojourner 100 years ago, been given as a gift or received as a payment for something." "How valuable?" I asked. "Last year, a cake of pu'er weighed 390 grams, a little under a pound, sold at auction for 1.2 million Hong Kong dollars. That's about 150,000 U.S. "My tea cake can't be worth anything like that," I said. "How do you know?" The next day, I brought my tea cake to see if he or someone else could tell me about it. People offered exorbitant sums to buy it, but Sean had the most tempting offer. Just as a person is searching for tea, the tea is searching for the person. "Come with me to China for a week. We'll make a pilgrimage to your tea cake's place of origin. Put yourself in my hands. I'll take care of everything." A pilgrimage to the place of origin. "I'll be going anyway," he added. "You may as well take advantage of me. My expertise, I mean." Okay, so I wasn't completely forthright with Professor Ho, my parents, or even myself. Sure, I'm totally into the project I got Professor Ho to advise me on. I've also got the Tufts project on my laptop, and I've looked at plenty of tea samples for Dr. Berry in the lab, which will help create a baseline for my research. When I'm in China, I'll meet farmers and collect my own tea samples. I'm going to win that Stanford Award. But there was, is, something about Sean. Because having an on-the-ground guide who speaks the language, that made me say yes to his offer. I went back to Stanford, and we communicated by email. We met at his house once when I was home for winter break to go over plans for the trip. I'd figured he was rich, so I wasn't surprised by the address in Pasadena, practically around the corner from Hummingbird Lane. It turned out to be a little more than a house, however. It was a grand old mansion built back in the day by some mucky muck. I figured it must have cost $15 million, give or take, which means that Sean isn't just rich. He's super rich. The grounds and the house looked beautiful and well-maintained from the outside. Inside, it had been gutted down to the studs. We wended our way through the construction to the old housekeeping quarters. The rooms were cozy and warm. One thing could have led to another, but he was all business, and so was I. And we need to keep it that way. We have separate rooms booked for every stop. I have the emails to prove it. Besides, nothing can happen if he isn't on this plane. As soon as the seatbelt sign is turned off, I walk toward the front of the plane. When I reach the curtain that divides coach from business, I pass through, trying to look like I belong. Most of the people are Chinese. About half of them are drinking champagne. A flight attendant asks, "Is this your cabin?" Busted. Back at my seat, I pull out my laptop and try to do work. I've gathered a lot of material about where I'm going and want to see if there are differences in how the various hill tribes use tea and rituals and folk medicines, as well as how they process it for drinking. Down the rabbit hole. About an hour later, a man's voice says, "You should have told me you're interested in Yunnan's ethnic minorities." It's Sean. He perches an elbow on the seat in front of me with his hand languidly hanging just inches from my face. He looks unbelievably elegant, which is not a word I've ever used about a guy. "I thought you might have missed the flight." I try to keep my voice even, but I'm not sure it works because I'm so relieved he's on the plane I can barely think. His mouth comes up at the corners. Not a smile, not a smirk. I have no idea what's in his mind. "I know some Dai, Bulong, and Akka farmers," he says. Everyone writes about the Dai because there are so many of them and they have their own written language. The hand that droops off the seat in front of me shoos away the idea as unworthy. He seems to run through the list in his mind, checking off each tribe one by one. Then, "You might be interested in the Akka because their culture is very similar to that of the Cree. The culture is animistic. Every living thing has a spirit. I've read about them and the whole Cree thing. Downside, the Akka get to have a bad rep similar to that of Native Americans. They don't save their money, they drink, they take drugs." His eyes flash. It's easy to fall for stereotypes. Ouch. I wasn't saying I believe those things. In the West, you think the individual is supreme, but the Akka see themselves as one link in the long chain of life, adjacent to all the other links of people and cultures, all carrying a collective wave toward the beach to throw a newborn up to safety. I feel myself bridling. Interesting that you bring up newborns. If everything has a soul, then what's up with that stuff about twins? That ended a while ago, he says, looking a little annoyed now. They had a cultural belief for, to them, common sense reasons, which they followed for millennia. Who are you to condemn their culture? Before I have a chance to clarify or defend myself, he taps the seat a couple times, done here, and glides back down the aisle, disappearing behind the curtain that divides the plane. "Well, that sucked," the girl next to me comments. He's waiting for me when I get off the plane in Guangzhou. I've had plenty of hours to formulate a proper answer to his question. Just because a group has a cultural belief, whether it's foot binding in China or female genital cutting in Africa, doesn't mean that we as humans should sanction the practice. But he seems to have forgotten our misunderstanding or whatever it was. We go through the border formalities, pick up our bags, pass through security for domestic flights, and board the plane for Kunming. Again, we aren't seated together, nor are we together on the last flight to Jinghong. After three back-to-back flights over many hours and time changes, I'm so punchy with exhaustion that I notice little about the airport other than it's small, drab, and dimly lit. Outside, a driver meets us to take us to Yiwu, the ancient collection center for the six great tea mountains, starting point of the Tea Horse Road, home of the Queen of Pur, and our base for the next four nights. It's about a six-hour drive, I've read, with bumpy hairpin turns. This after all the flights and layovers. I take a Dramamine, roll my hoodie into a pillow, and rest my head. On his side of the back seat, Sean immediately nods off, but as tired as I am, I can't fall asleep. China. And I'm heading to the middle of nowhere. This is a far different trip than the one I took with my parents. I quickly need to become accustomed to squat toilets, using toilet paper for napkins, and seeing people spit their chicken and fish bones right on the floor. For breakfast, and jet-lagged as hell, we go to an outdoor stand and order chili-flavored soup noodles being cooked over a brazier. We sit on plastic kitty chairs around a low kitty-sized table, which is plain weird, that looks like it's never once been wiped down. A dog chews on a bone at my feet. I don't see a single white face, but there are others who are clearly marked as foreign to Yiwu. Chinese men dressed in spiffy trousers, starched shirts, and polished loafers. Tea traders, Sean whispers. Watch how they act with each other. It's like the gold rush out here. I found my load, and I'm not going to tell you where it is. They're checking us out, too, to see how prosperous we are and determine if we'll drive up the price of tea this year. When our noodles arrive, I follow Sean's example and pour steaming tea over my chopsticks and other tableware, then toss the dirty liquid on the ground. The alternative would be the trots, or worse. Every pandemic in the history of the world has come from China. The tea traders leave as quickly as they came. Sean calls farmers and dealers on WeChat, an instant messaging system that allows him to speak into his phone instead of typing complicated Chinese characters, giving me an update after each. I told them to expect us at 4 o'clock, or they said drop by tomorrow. I've never brought a woman with me. They're eager to meet you. We're just about to leave when a man who introduces himself as a new dealer sits down next to us, unzips an overnight bag to show us bundled wads of 100 yuan notes, and asks where he should go find good tea. Sean sends him to a family-owned tea processing factory up the road. As we walk away, I ask, should I see it too? I'm going to take you somewhere better and more authentic tomorrow. Today, let me show you around the town. From what's left of it, I imagine Yiwu must have once been very beautiful, but the main street is just a strip of clunky concrete enterprises all coated in dust and dirt from the old houses being torn down and from the cheap and ugly buildings going up. We walk part of the Tea Horse Road, which, disappointingly, doesn't look like much. Just a 4-foot-wide cobblestone path that snakes through the old part of town and then heads down a hill. On our way back to the main drag, we pass along quiet lanes where a few traditional buildings made of unfired clay bricks and upturned eaves still stand. Chickens peck at the ground and flowers drip over walls. Before every house, women, the younger ones in jeans and t-shirts, the old ladies in traditional clothes, and all of them wearing scarves or headdresses, sort tea a leaf at a time. This is what Yiwu must have looked like before prosperity hit, and it's much more quaint and charming, giving the feel of ageless China. The next day, our plan is to go to Lao Banzhang, the home of the King of Pu'er. We're driven over an impossible one-lane dirt road. We pass villages made up of between 10 and 50 houses. I glimpse a few handmade wooden gates that look a lot like the entrance to our ranch in Colorado, 2 posts and a beam. Our gate has our brand carved on a wooden disc and mounted on the beam. Here, the embellishments on each gate are, let's just say, out there, with carvings of a man and a woman with outsized genitals verging on the pornographic. It's odd to reconcile the primitiveness of these figures with a country that's now an economic superpower. The cultural disconnect is magnified when the driver is forced to stop the car because a tangle of minivans has blocked the route. Japanese tourists take each other's photos posing against tea trees that cling to the hillside. Here, in the middle of nowhere. We get out of the car and chat with them for a bit in English. We're surrounded by mountains, blanketed in gray haze, and I mentally try to match them to the markings on my tea cake, to no avail. The tourists, so strange to see them out here, get back in their vans. Sean waves the various drivers through the contortions required to clear the road. Finally, we're able to get back in the car. Our driver takes us to a prosperous grower's house, modern and clean, with several outbuildings for processing tea. In the courtyard, about 2 dozen women sit around big flat baskets sorting tea. The owner, a Mr. Pugh, introduces me to the group as an American scientist, and they show me every step of the tea-making process. I even get to try killing the green and kneading. Around noon, several cars arrive, bringing buyers from around the world. We sit in a pavilion on, of course, little plastic kitty chairs around a low table and taste tea worth $1,000 for a 2-ounce cup. I don't speak Chinese, but they all speak English. When a dealer from Taiwan asks about my project, I tell them a little about it, ending with, "Almost everywhere I look, I see another opportunity for scientific study. For example, what effect will pollution have on the tea industry?" "We have no smog here," Mr. Pugh scoffs. "Really? Then what's that stuff in the air?" I ask, pointing to the haze that lies between the hills. "I grew up in Los Angeles. I know what smog looks like. What you're seeing could have drifted here from 1,000 miles away. But I'm wondering, too, if the slash-and-burn agricultural practices of the ethnic minorities are now catching up to them in this era of climate change." The others nod politely, but I'm not sure they agree with me. "How can the exact age of an antique cake of pu'er be known?" I continue. "Is there something in it that could actually promote longevity? Is pu'er a medicinal tonic, a drinkable antique, or merely a beverage?" "What about social issues?" Sean asks me. "Could tea be seen as a symbol of worth, a commodity that represents change in value for women and for China on the world stage?" At the word women, the others exchange glances like we're all a bunch of teenagers instead of an international group of travelers outside a farmer's house miles from anything resembling what I think of as civilization. But they pull themselves together quickly, because everyone seems to have an opinion about where I should go, what I should see, and whom I should meet. Soon, most of them have pulled out their cell phones and are making even more connections for Sean and me on WeChat. I'm going to have plenty of subjects for my project by the time I meet up with the Tufts team. After we've sampled about 12 teas, lunch is served at an adjacent, child-size, again, table, stir-fried cabbage, tomato and scrambled egg, beef with slivered ginger, and some type of crunchy root. Once the meal is finished, we move back to the tea table. Just as everyone's getting settled, Sean says, "Haley, why don't you show them your tea cake? Maybe someone here will recognize the wrapper." I pull it out of my bag and lay it on the table. People are polite enough not to touch it, but they stand to get better views, craning their necks, pointing and discussing. "It must be from a lost tea company," Mr. Pugh guesses. "Or a lost family," the dealer from Taiwan offers. "Or from a long abandoned garden high in the mountains," someone's girlfriend suggests. "How old is it?" Mr. Pugh asks. "I don't know," I answer. "Tea cakes made before the 50s had no wrappers," someone said, "so that's a clue." "But it's clearly much older than that," the dealer from Taiwan interrupts. "It looks to be hundreds of years old." Somehow it's gratifying that the tea cake is as mysterious to them as it's always been to me. "Have you tasted it?" Mr. Pugh asks. "The idea seems shocking to me. I've never opened it," I admit. "Let's do it now," Mr. Pugh says, reaching for the cake. "Let's taste it." Quick as a snake, Sean clamps his hand over our host's wrist. It's for Haley to decide when and if she wishes to open it. An awkward silence falls over the little group. "He never brings a girl to visit," Mr. Pugh jokes, trying to diffuse the tension. "Now look how proprietary he is." The others laugh. Sean releases his grip. More tea is poured. A few hours later, Sean and I pile into the car. My bag is filled with tea samples and tea gifts given by our host, who says, "So you'll always remember our day together." When we get back to Yiwu, we walk down the dusty street to a restaurant with smears of I don't know what on the plate glass windows. Sean orders soup and a simple assortment of vegetable dishes. "Everything has been so go, go, go that we haven't had much of a chance to talk about anything beyond travel logistics and tea. But now," he asks, "if this is my first time to China." "Do I look out of place?" I ask. He raises his eyebrows. "Yes." "It's my second trip," I say. "I was 17 the first time I came. I'm adopted, and my parents brought me on a heritage tour to find my roots." "And did you find them?" he asks coolly, showing no surprise about my background. "My roots? Nope, but that's all right." I feel compelled to explain. "I have a loving family. I grew up in a beautiful home. I'm getting a great education and following my dreams, which is why you're here with me." Yikes. An awkward silence. I force myself to forge ahead. "A few years ago, someone told me about a concept called the grateful but angry Chinese adoptee. Yes, I've been grateful, and yes, I've been angry. It was hard for me to separate what I should be grateful for and what I was actually grateful for. I guess that's why I decided it should be grateful and angry, not but angry. That was a long time ago. Now what I feel is something more like survivor's guilt. Do you know what I mean? Perhaps I do, he answers with a hint of sadness, but I don't feel comfortable probing into his background. I could have ended up in a sucky life, I yammer on. Instead, I got a fabulous life. A lot of girls like me feel we need to account for ourselves in a bigger way than people who just come home from the hospital, no questions asked. I will myself to stop talking. But then, maybe this is more than you want to know. I want to know everything about you. I guess I set him up for that, but it's such a dopey line I can't even drum up a comeback. Even he looks embarrassed. Is he going to talk about himself for a while? I'm not that lucky. Do you see yourself as Chinese or American? 100% American and 100% Chinese, I answer. I'm not half and half, I'm fully both. I'll forever wear my Chinese-ness on my face, but these days when I look in the mirror, I don't see how mismatched I am in my birth family or that I don't feel Chinese enough. I just see me. My comment startles me. I struggled so long with who I was. Have I actually come to a place of acceptance? You're a new kind of global citizen, he says. You can be a bridge between two cultures and two countries. That's going a little far, don't you think? Not really. And it's not just about you, is it? You and your cohort are products of the one-child policy, which is now over, right? I've heard that over 400 million births were prevented, but all of you are in a special category. Your perspective and those of other women like you is unique. It's larger than any of you as individuals. In a way, you do have immense responsibility. I used to resent that, but it has given me a sense of purpose. The power of international Chinese adoptees all around the world could be a force to be reckoned with. Now for sure he's teasing me. I give him a half smile, and we return to our meal. Later, he walks me all the way to my hotel room. My dad would undoubtedly be relieved to know that another night goes by without any funny business. On the third morning, we visit a villa so remote that there isn't another house in view, with a vista that reminds me a lot of Topanga Canyon back home. The living room is floored in white marble, a gigantic flat-screen TV blares from a cabinet the size of Nebraska, and a fortune in tea, packed in oversized bags, is stacked against the walls. Our hostess asks us to stay for lunch. We'll kill a chicken, she says, and the next thing I hear is a chicken's neck being snapped just inches from my ear. I taste whatever's put in my bowl, including anteater and bear paw, out of politeness. I show her my tea cake, but she doesn't have any ideas about it. From here, we stop in to meet several farmers. Wherever we go, three things happen. First, as soon as we arrive, water is heated, leaves rinsed, and tea steeped. We meet those who treat it as something treasured. But more often than not, we're across from a farmer or his son who chain smokes. Ashes and cigarette butts overflow ashtrays, even though we're tasting something that relies on aroma and flavor. One man even uses his electric razor while we're sipping his tea. People tell me incredible stories of poverty, hardship, sacrifice, and overnight wealth. Farmers proudly point out their running water, televisions, and motor scooters. Second, I show people my tea cake. Everyone has a theory about it, but no one can tell me definitely what it is or where it came from. And third, folks are kind to me, but they rib Sean mercilessly. He laughs, he blushes, he ducks his head and runs his hand through his hair, chagrined but pleased. He then translates everything, or I think he does, because why else would he tell me things like, they say your hair looks like silk, they wonder if you're an ethnic minority and how many children you can have in America. And they want you to know that you'll always be safe and happy with me. As we drive from place to place, he sits on his side of the back seat and I stay on mine, but the roads are bumpy with lots of curves and the laws of physics, so there's that. But otherwise, we don't do any of the obvious things like walking so close together that our fingers touch or staring too long into each other's eyes when he says something like, "In drinking the best tea, you and I are having a conversation with the wind and the rain that the ancient Taoists had above the mountain clouds." Through the tea liquor, across streams, and under moon shadows, we can understand that the separation between man and nature is not real. I mean, come on! Who wouldn't want to sleep with a guy who talks like that? But he doesn't make a move, and I mostly keep my eyes on the scenery. I've had casual hookups and even a few short relationships, but this feels different. I can wait, but the anticipation only fuels my desire. Our fourth day is spent entirely in the car, as we're driven down from Yiwu to Meng Hai and then up Nanuo Mountain, which he tells me has the largest number of ancient tea tree groves. We check into a rustic inn. The main building has a kitchen, tea shop, and small tea processing area on the ground floor. The family lives upstairs. Guests stay in bungalows built in the traditional style, bamboo and thatch on stilts that edge a canyon. Mine is outfitted with a bed, period. There's no electricity, and the toilet and shower are in a separate building to be shared by everyone here. Sean and I eat outside by candlelight. The proprietor's mother makes a simple meal from ingredients grown on the property, a soup flavored with fresh mint, string beans sautéed with chili, greens with slivered chilies, and scrambled egg and tomato, which we eat seated at the ubiquitous tiny chairs and table. After dinner, fiery homemade liquor is brought out and the proprietor performs Dai drinking songs for the handful of guests. Last, he asks us to join in a call-and-response Aka love song that was recently made into a hit on a talent show on Chinese television. Sean translates as the other male guests sing to the women. The flowers bloom at their peaks, waiting for the butterflies to come. Then the women sing to the men. The honeycombs wait for the bees to make honey. Then back to the men. A beautiful flower calls to her love. We're both able to join the chorus. After the festivities, we're handed oil lamps. Sean guides me to my bungalow. He leans in, barely brushing his lips against mine. He pulls back to gauge my reaction. The air feels so heavy between us I can barely breathe. He puts a hand on the small of my back and pulls me to him. Our kiss is like nothing I've ever experienced. In another minute, we're in my little room. The oil lamps flicker. He slowly undresses me. "You're beautiful," he says. Nothing in my life has prepared me for what I feel when we make love. Afterward, I lie in his arms. Something extraordinary is happening, but is it too fast? He edges up onto an elbow so he can stare into my eyes. I don't know how, but I feel as though he knows me completely and somehow I know him. And then he says the most remarkable thing. "I've loved you from the moment you walked into my booth at the Tea Expo. I've brought you to the place I love most in the world. Wouldn't it be incredible if we could spend our lives traveling the world, drinking tea and reading the great poets?" The realities of our lives escape me for a moment. We make love again, and it's even more exquisite. When he falls asleep, I let my breathing follow his. The next morning begins as it usually does, with Sean on WeChat, contacting the people we're going to see, but with every second heightened by blissful joy. Then we get in the car and set off. After an hour, we're driven onto a narrow, unpaved stretch you could barely call a road. We reach a gate, watched by a couple of men. They recognize Sean immediately and wave us through, but we don't go far before we reach another gate. It's decorated like some of the others I've glimpsed off the side of the main road, with a man with a gigantic penis and a woman with bulging breasts. "We need to walk the rest of the way," Sean says. The driver parks the car. Sean and I pass through the gate. He warns me not to touch the posts and proceed along a path. The wind rustles through the trees, cicadas whine, birds trill. The moist tropical air feels warm and soothing on my skin. The first thing I see when we reach the village are some barefoot children washing dishes in a pig trough. In the end, though, it's much like the other villages we visited. Everyone is involved in tea processing. People are bringing in baskets of tea leaves and spreading them on raised platforms to wilt, killing the green in outdoor walks over wood fires, kneading, steaming, or doing the twist on the heavy round stones that will press the tea into cakes. We reach a house where a group of women sit around flat baskets sorting tea. One of them is quite old and wearing full ethnic minority clothing. A little boy, 8 or 9, sits next to her.